You're listening to Builderpedia, your go-to podcast for everything you need to know about property. By covering the entire journey from buying your home through to design, building, selling, and everything in between, we'll help you fill in the blanks and bring your property vision to life.
Welcome to the latest episode of Builderpedia. Joining us today is Alan Kohler, someone who I've known of for a long time, admired for a long time, and I'm very, very grateful that you've come on. Welcome, Alan.
Thanks, Matt. Good to be here.
So, Alan, why I asked you to come on the podcast was I was very much interested in your article, The Great Divide, in the Quarterly Essay, which is, I think you published as a book as well, but I listened to it in the Quarterly Essay. And I just wanted to ask what made you, because you've published a lot and a lot of your stuff is about investment and shares, and what made you interested in the Great Divide and housing?
Oh, well, I suppose the thing that sort of got me most interested was the fact that my children all started buying houses and found it very difficult. So it kind of came home to me what a change had happened in Australia about housing. And I was writing about it in my columns for various publications. So it was a, you know, housing is an important economic subject. I was kind of starting to write about it. The editors of Quarterly Essay read the columns and approached me and asked me to write an essay about the subject. So I thought about it for a bit and then said yes.
Yeah, it feels like there was a lot of research that went into it. You must have spent quite a bit of time and energy on putting it together, or is that just a combination of thinking about it and writing about it for a while and pulling it all together?
No, I did some work on it. It was, and I enjoyed it. It was great. I mean, most of my life as a journalist is kind of dipping into subjects. So I really enjoyed getting stuck into it and learning about it in more detail.
Yeah. And what's interesting is you're in Melbourne and it's a national subject, but I'm kind of wondering, in Sydney, there's upheaval around planning. What's happening in Melbourne? I mean, in Sydney, it's the state government essentially ramming through mass rezonings around transport is a real talking point in the property industry. But what's happening in Melbourne? Is that
same thing?
Yeah.
The state government, as a part of the National Housing Accord, the government has committed to building a certain number of houses. I think it's, I can't remember the number, but they've given the councils, all the local councils, a target of houses they have to build. And that involves upzoning around stations mainly. So yeah, they're doing the same thing as in Sydney.
Your Quarterly Essay, The Great Divide, I found it at the airport on the way to Melbourne and I listened to most of it in Melbourne. It feels a little bit, and I don't know whether it's my circle of friends in Melbourne, but Melbourne feels like it's lost its mojo a little bit. And I wonder if that's a perspective. And I'm thinking of things like when you talk to people about in Sydney about the metro, they're excited about the metro and the infrastructure. In Melbourne, the comments were more like, well, they're taken forever. We don't know where it's going and it's probably not going in the right place. Is Melbourne losing its way a little bit, or is that just a perspective from a Sydney sider?
Oh, no, I think there's something in that. Melbourne had a particularly bad pandemic. There were more lockdowns. They were harsher, more difficult in Melbourne. And it cost more, the pandemic. And so the government is, the sense in Melbourne, I think is fair to say, is that the government's more or less broke now. There's an awful lot of roadworks going on for various things. There's tunnels and new roads being built, which is fine. It's a good thing. But in the meantime, it's difficult. There's a new underground railway going under the city, which is kind of closing lots of roads. And as you say, the airport's hard because there's no train line. So, you know, that's difficult. So, look, I think it's fair to say life in Melbourne is pretty tough on the whole. And there's a sense that the government is to blame. So, you know, I think it's probably fair to say that Victorians in general are waiting with a baseball bat for the next election.
Yeah, right. And I guess because prior to the pandemic, like 5-10 years ago, Melbourne was on the ascendancy. It was the cultural capital. It was taken over. It was going to be bigger than Sydney. It was going to be better than Sydney. And it's kind of flipped in a funny way. And surely, the pandemic's part of that, but surely that there's something else. And I don't know what it is.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Oh, look, I wouldn't want to overstate it. I think, you know, I don't think Melbourne's falling apart in some way. It's okay. I mean, life's going on. I think the loss of mojo possibly is a good way to say.
Yeah. All right. I'll leave it there. Back to what we're talking about, I guess, in housing. And the thing that struck me with your book is The Great Divide is that there were housing crises, there were booms and busts in the past. And I just wanted to ask you, how unique do you think the situation is now?
Well, look, I think what's happened is a sustained growth in house prices faster than incomes and GDP and most other things. So, and this has been a 25-year process. So as you say, there have been sort of lots of booms and busts that have taken place. Obviously, there was a boom and bust in the late 1980s. The bust occurred in the recession of 1991. But that was a kind of a brief period. House prices went up. Commercial property prices went up a lot in the late 80s. And then there was a bust. After World War II, there was a big increase in house prices when the price controls were lifted that were imposed during the war. And there was a big bust in 1892, 1993, causing a depression. So yeah, as you say, there've been ups and downs, but what's occurred this time is a sustained growth, average per annum growth in house prices by 6 or 7% over the past 25 years on average. And that's more than twice the growth in wages. And the result of that is we have an affordability crisis. I mean, it's simply the case that house prices have grown from 3 to 4 times average incomes to 9 times average incomes now. And there's no sign of that really abating. I mean, the house prices have peaked, particularly in Melbourne and Sydney, still rising in Perth, Adelaide and Brisbane, but we're still a long way from getting things back to the way they were.
So why won't they self-correct? What's the driver that stops it from the bust?
Well, this isn't a bubble and bust situation. This is a structural change in the economy that's occurred for a number of reasons that started off in the year 2000. And in the book, I kind of go through them. There were 4 things that happened in around about the year 2000. One was the change in the capital gains tax that was halved. Instead of being adjusted for inflation, the capital gains tax was discounted by 50%. Interest rates were cut after the United States tech bubble bust. The US cut interest rates, went into recession in 2000. Australia didn't have a recession, but interest rates were cut in order to stop the dollar rising too much. And that was an important fact. The Howard government brought back first home buyer grants, which had been dropped for a while. That they were first home buyer grants were first introduced in the 1960s, and they were reintroduced by Howard in around about the year 2000. And the 4th thing, which was reasonably important, very important, was that the rules for student housing, the student visas, were changed in July 2000. So whereas previously, before that, there were gazetted and non-gazetted countries for students, foreign students to come to Australia. The gazetted countries were UK, Canada, New Zealand, United States. Non-gazetted countries included China and India. And after July 1 that year, that was changed to remove the distinction. And so all foreign students were treated the same, which I think obviously is a good thing. And the distinction was a hangover from White Australia policy, which was obviously not what should be going on. And so that was removed correctly. And at the same time, the pathway from student visa to permanent residency was made easier and more transparent. And so what you had from that year was a big influx of foreign students from China and India. And after about 3 years, that turned into a huge doubling and then tripling of permanent residents. And so you had, after about 2005, there was a massive increase in immigration, which was not matched with housing. And so from 2005 to 2015, there was a major housing shortage, I think to some extent caused by immigration, but also the extra demand from investors. And there was no change to the way that zoning applied and the sort of the amount of construction that was taking place. So, you know, you ended up with a 10-year shortage of housing. And that was alleviated to some extent after 2015 when immigration fell. There was a bit of a boom in housing. But post the pandemic, we've gone back into a shortage.
And do you think immigration is the problem or is it the balance? Because my take on immigration is we're bringing in lots of brilliant people from middle-class families who have very little in the way of skills and experience. So it's not actually the immigration, it's the balance of bringing in students who are studying sometimes phantom courses. It's actually a path to migration rather than a serious degree at times. Not all of them. Some of them are very legitimate, but some, I mean, I know this because I talk to people who are laboring with us in our business. And yeah, a lot of those courses are a little bit of a sham. Do you think was migration the mistake opening it up, or was it the balance of too many students?
Look, I think that it's tempting to describe something as the problem, right? There is no the problem. There's lots of them. And immigration, I think, has been one of them. Immigration is something we need. Australia absolutely has to have immigration, lots of it. We don't have enough people to run the place, basically. So immigration is terribly important, but it needs to be matched with construction of houses, obviously. I mean, and one of the reasons that there's a bit of a problem, I mean, it's just simple if you think about it. The number of people who immigrate into Australia who are in construction industry is very small. I mean, it's like something like 1%, maybe 2% of immigrants are tradesmen, tradespeople. So very few of them are building houses. But all immigrants have to live in a house. So the immigration is not, in a sense, self-sustaining when it comes to housing them. I think the government, like last week, announced that they were going to ensure that more of the immigrants are in construction, which is a bit bloody late, I'd say. I mean, that's something they should have thought of before. But anyway, they finally thought of it. And oh, crikey, we better make sure there's more tradespeople who are brought in.
Absolutely. And I think that's the conundrum. And so my head of operations is Pakistani, and he's been with us for 10 years. And at one point he proposed, I'll bring in trades from Pakistan. There's plenty of very good tradesmen. There's tilers, there's bricklayers, there's people there. Now, he was very bullish about it until he realized that none of those people had any chance of passing the English test. Whereas I think in other countries, in parts of the Middle East or Singapore, that's not as big a problem. We've got this quite difficult English test to allow people in. And I don't think some of my Irish labourers would pass that test.
I think it's also true that a lot of countries' trade certificates don't operate in Australia. You can't use them here. You have to go back to school when you come here. So I think it's a little bit complicated. There needs to be some adjustment. They can't just sort of wave a wand and say, we're going to have more tradespeople coming in as immigrants. You know, they've got to deal with the certification of them, make sure that they are allowed to work here. And as you say, deal with the English. I mean, the government can do it. That's their job.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the impediments, and again, I'd be keen to get your input on it. One of the impediments from my perspective, watching governments throw money and lots of money at this, is they're obsessed with training. And I kind of think of, I guess, from our perspective or from federal government's perspective, Australia is seen as a tier one economy. It's seen, so if you're a tier one company and you're short of staff, you don't deal with that by starting a training program. Whereas again and again and again, we've just been obsessed with training. And I think the problem with training is it pulls people from trades to be the trainers, but also it's a long-term solution, whereas we've got a short-term problem.
Absolutely, that's right.
So another thing that struck me in your book, which was there were solutions, but at the moment what's happening, and I know this because so many developers have told me first person, they have sites and they have approvals and they're just not viable. And the gorilla in the room is cost. So what else can governments do to help with that? What else can supercharge that and nudge developers over the line? Because on a risk-adjusted basis, the development, the build doesn't stack up. They're not sure they're going to get their money back.
Yeah, that's right. In particular, house apartments are too expensive at the moment to build because of the cost of concrete and steel have both gone up a lot. I spoke to a developer the other day who told me that the cost of building an apartment is around about $14,000 per square metre. Well, this is on average, kind of broadly speaking. But the cost of building a house in Greenfields is $4,000 or $5,000 per square metre.
Yeah.
And as soon as you start building something with a crane, you are unionised, And that adds another 15 to 20% to the cost of the building. So there's two things that have increased the cost of apartments: the very large increase in the cost of cement and steel, and secondly, the unionisation. And there's been a lot of stories about the CFMEU and how effective they are at looking after their members. Obviously, some of the reporting has been rather more negative than that, but anyway, the truth is that they are quite an effective union and they've got good rates. And once you get into high rise, the building has to be unionised. So, or it's not required by law to be unionised, as I understand it, but it's very difficult to get insurance if you don't. You probably know more about that than I do, Matt.
Yeah, I don't know a lot about union because our developments are much smaller. We do much smaller jobs. And it's not talked about in Sydney. I have been told that unions are much stronger in Victoria than they are in New South Wales. New South Wales probably did a lot more to break union power. But I think it's not something that comes up in the conversation. It's not an impediment. It's not a cost factor. In New South Wales, and what's come in is new legislation with an additional layer of red tape for apartment buildings. It's called the Build Practitioner, Design Practitioner Act. And it's in response to some well-known defective product or well-known building disasters, Opal Tower and Homebush, Mascot Towers. You may have heard of those.
Yeah.
But it feels like breaking a nut with a sledgehammer. It's adding many tens of thousands of dollars to each apartment to comply.
There's also a national construction code that has added cost by requiring more energy, higher energy standards for climate change. So these are all good things, but as you say, possibly, gone a bit far, or at least when you add them all up, it's kind of made apartment development at least uneconomic at the moment. And so I don't know about Sydney, but the only apartments that are being built here are downsizer apartments for baby boomers, and they're not affordable. They're affordable for downsizers, but they're expensive. The minimum price for an apartment, for a two-bedroom apartment, is about $700,000 to $800,000. And once you get up to a decent-sized three-bedroom apartment, three- or four-bedroom apartment where you could bring up a family, we're talking about $2 million. And so clearly where we are at the moment is that the housing that can be built is not affordable housing.
Does it help, though? Some people say more housing, it doesn't matter if it's luxury housing. If you just build more of whatever, it still helps. But is it not really solving the problem of affordable housing?
Well, obviously it's not. I mean, yeah, it's true that more housing is good. If what you're doing is providing a lot more housing for downsizers, more people will downsize, arguably, and then the houses that they're leaving will come onto the market. And if there's a lot of houses, of those houses coming onto the market, that would, be likely to drive the price down. So, yeah, I mean, more housing is a good thing, but more expensive housing doesn't really do the trick.
Yeah. And so I guess greenfield development, it's been described, if I'm not mistaken, the Property Council described greenfield development, which is a cost, definitely driven by cost. Greenfield development is, in their view, in maybe imperfect words, the engine of the economy, but it's very short term. And surely in the long term, it's more expensive because the state government needs to build more roads, more schools, more, like, it's cheaper in the short term. It feels a little bit like a sugar hit, but surely there should be some way to subsidize. Yeah, not that I'm thinking like that, but surely it's better in the long term for the state government to subsidize apartment buildings to lower the cost, because they're going to save money on roads, schools, and other things, as well as the other costs, like more congestion and more all those other externalities. Is that a reasonable assumption, or is there a flaw in that kind of?
I don't know. I mean, it's kind of right, but the thing is that the Victorian and New South Wales governments have both gone for increasing the supply of housing by building around existing infrastructure in existing suburbs. They're looking to densify the suburbs rather than to do new greenfields. I mean, it's not 100%, 0%. It's something like 70 to 30, So most, about 70% of the housing they want to build is in existing suburbs around existing infrastructure. And that's because that doesn't cost the government anymore. They can just use the existing infrastructure and work it harder. And so that means that the cost of the housing is more on the developers, whereas in greenfields developments, the cost is more on the government because they have to, as you say, they have to build more infrastructure. They've got to build more roads, public transport, schools, hospitals, and so on. And so that's why, because, I mean, New South Wales government isn't as broke as Victoria's, but still they're in deficit. They need to not spend any money. So they're trying to put the cost on the developers and not on themselves. So, okay, that's where we're at. The problem with that is that you still need to improve or expand the infrastructure around in existing suburbs if you're going to densify them. You need more schools, more hospitals, better public transport, better roads, and so on. You still need to improve the infrastructure. And to some extent, I don't want to overstate this, but to some extent, there's a sort of divide between the government or the Labor Party and the Coalition on this. The Labor Party is going for the densification. The Coalition's policy involves $5 billion for new infrastructure. So they kind of are saying, the Coalition's saying that we're in favor of new greenfields development and we're going to pay $5 billion to build the infrastructure for that. Now, I mean, I don't know whether that's enough. It doesn't sound like anywhere near enough to do what's required, but there it is. That's what they're talking about.
It's a nice round number, but it doesn't.
Yeah. I know it's a number. It sounds like a nice big number, round number, but you know, what they're not saying is we will spend whatever it takes to provide the amount of housing that Australia needs. No one's saying that. They're sort of saying, you know, the government is saying we'll build 1.2 million houses over 5 years or have them built, which is going to be nowhere near met. And the Coalition's saying we're going to come up with $5 billion for infrastructure. Well, these are all round numbers that kind of either, firstly, probably won't be met. And secondly, no one's saying we're going to do what's needed. We're going to provide the housing what's needed. I mean, housing is an essential service. Housing is a human essential. And all the governments of the world say that housing is a human right. But what no government says, except for some governments in Europe and certainly the Australian governments, state or federal, what they don't say is housing is a human right and an essential, and we'll make sure everyone's got one that they can afford. So no one's saying that, and they're kind of putting numbers on it. But the result is that we've got 120,000, 130,000 homeless people and lots of people who are going backwards each month because their repayments on their mortgage is more than 50% of their income. And so, you know, we've got a terrible situation in this country where housing is acknowledged to be an essential and a human right, but it's not actually provided.
So I guess my question, maybe better phrased from before, is what else can a government do? Well, the Minns government in New South Wales has put all their effort into rezoning and relaxing planning law and a patent book, which we'll see, but it's intended to streamline approvals. But at the moment, approvals aren't the issue holding everyone back so much. It's cost. So what else should or can government do right here, right now? Because it feels like the changes to planning law, it helps, but it's not going to turn the ship around.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? So we bump up against, well, should governments build the houses? Because developers can't. It doesn't work out. There's no profit in it. So the question is there now a market failure? Then if so, should the government step in? And no government wants to get in the business of building houses. They're all kind of, if you look at the charts of construction in Australia, housing construction is declining and engineering construction, as it's called, which is infrastructure, is going through the roof, public infrastructure. So governments are all spending huge amounts of money on roads and bridges and tunnels and railway lines, which is great. But what they're not doing is building housing, and the housing construction is declining because, as you say, it's not viable. So now what? Okay. I mean, what do you do now? I mean, by the way, most of the infrastructure that's being built, a lot of the infrastructure that's being built is private capital going in. So that what they're doing is mobilizing private capital with guaranteed returns through tolls, particularly on toll roads, obviously, but also in other areas, tunnels and so on. And that works fine, you know, except it's like just another tax, right? So it costs us an absolute fortune to drive from Bankstown to the city. I don't know what it is there, but for me to get into the city in Melbourne via the Transurban Road, it cost $5 both ways. So that's $10 a day, right? So that's a tax that didn't exist before, and it's a tax that pays for the road. So, okay, that's the way it's going. So all these roads are being built, you know, helter-skelter, no problem. So here we are with a market failure in housing. So what's the government going to do? Can they provide some way of mobilizing private capital into housing? So they're thinking about that. They're trying to think about how do we do that. They've created the Housing Australia Future Fund with an amount of $10 billion, and the income from that fund is meant to subsidize affordable housing, but it's kind of nowhere near enough. It's just not enough money. It's creating some housing, but not that much. So the problem is the super funds, obviously Australian superannuation has got $4 trillion in it and tons of money available to invest. The super funds are all investing in built-to-rent properties in other countries, in America in particular, but also Norway, but they're not doing it in Australia, right? So now the government has said, well, we're going to try and subsidise built-to-rent. But it's a bit, you know, half-assed. It's sort of, you know, it's not really going to do it.
So what is Norway and the US doing differently that allows built-to-rent to be viable? Is it the economic condition and the demand, or is it something structurally different in those economies that make built-to-rent viable?
The main thing that's structurally different is negative gearing and capital gains tax, which means that in Australia, the apartments have traditionally all been bought by individuals who can use the negative gearing, whereas institutions can't, particularly super funds that are taxed at a low rate. So when a developer builds a high-rise apartment building, what happens to the apartments is they all get sold individually to people who are negative gearers mainly, I think. The built-to-rent idea is that the developer who's behind the institution would own the thing and rent it out. And I think the main change to the built-to-rent rules is that they've changed the taxation or reduced the taxation of foreign capital for built-to-rent from 30% back to 15%, so that even as the playing field, right? So they're going to tax foreign companies who do built-to-rent in Australia at the same rate as local ones. But I don't think that's going to do much, really. I mean, it might encourage a bit of foreign capital into the area, but...
But the capital's here.
It's just not enough.
You're saying that Australian super funds are investing overseas in similar things. So what's the tweak? So obviously, reducing the tax on foreign investment isn't going to change that. What's going to make the Australian super funds invest in built-to-rent?
So the main thing is that super funds are judged by benchmarks, by APRA, right? So the way the superannuation rules works for big funds is that they have to beat benchmarks in order to keep operating, because if they miss the benchmarks 2 years in a row, they're not allowed to take on new members for a while. They get in the sin bin. Now, with property, the benchmark that the APRA uses in order to measure the super funds is something called the MSCI Mercer benchmark, and it is 40% office, 25% retail, 25% warehousing or industrial. And the residential component of that benchmark is about 2%. So basically, Australian super funds, there's nothing in it for them to invest in residential because they have to watch the benchmark. They have to match the benchmark that APRA applies to them, or else they're in danger of missing the benchmark and then being rubbed out. And that's the reason that they invest in overseas built-to-rent. They want to invest in residential, but in Australia they can't. But those benchmarks, that MSCI Mercer asset allocation, doesn't apply to overseas. They have a kind of a lump amount that they're allowed to invest overseas, and that could be anything they like. So that they invest in built-to-rent because they want to, because it's a good thing to invest in, but they can only do it overseas because APRA basically allows them to.
Yeah, but it seems illogical. Like, what's the logic behind that rule?
Well, there's no logic at all. It's completely arbitrary, and they just kind of came up with this benchmark, and here it is. We're using the MSCI Mercer asset allocation rules, and there it is. And it's mostly office now has gone backwards 20% last year because of working from home. Office is in dire trouble. They're all losing money in office, but they have to do it because of the APRA rules. So that needs to change, right? If they change the benchmark, the APRA benchmark on super funds to include, I don't know, 20% residential, that would immediately release a colossal amount of funds into residential building because they want to do it because it's a good thing to invest in.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that I've learned about investors, and I'd be keen to know your thoughts, is as much as they're driven by returns, a lot of investors want to invest in something meaningful and help and good. And it a little bit of it's, I guess, brand alignment. But I found sometimes to a point of pain where you present something that stacks up, but your investor has some idea in their mind of doing it a particular way that's meaningful to them. I wonder if that's just me or whether that resonates with you.
Oh, yeah, that's true. The problem here is that super funds require a return of about 9%, 9 or 10%, and they get it from the stock market. And that tends to be achieved via 6% capital growth, 3% yield. And that sort of applies, has been applying to residential housing, 2 or 3% rental yield plus 6% capital growth. And as I said at the start of this recording, that's been the situation over the past 25 years. But really, that's the problem. In a way, we can't allow super funds to get the returns that they want from residential housing because that implies that house prices will keep increasing at 6% per annum. And we don't want that to happen, right? So we want super funds to not receive the returns that they've been getting. We need their returns to come back to, I don't know, 4 or 5%, but they don't invest in stuff for 4 or 5% returns. That's bad. They don't want to do that. So the question then is, are governments prepared to make up the gap? And that's the idea of the Housing Australia Future Fund. You know, essentially the income from that corpus of money, $10 billion, is meant to make up the gap between what affordable housing needs to return, which is not that much, and what the super funds require. But as I said, there's just not enough of it. There's not enough money. So if governments really want to mobilise a lot of super fund money, they not only have to allow them to do it through the asset allocation rules, they have to somehow subsidise the returns. Or the other thing to do, which is a cheaper thing to do, is to require the super funds to invest a proportion of the money into residential housing in return for the tax benefits they get. Now, there used to be a rule before the Hawke-Keating government called the 30-20 rule, and that was in return for the tax benefit that pension funds got, they had to invest 30% of their money into government securities and 20% of it had to be in federal government. So it was 30-20, 30% in government overall, 20% of that in federal government securities, that is to say government bonds. And that was the deal, right? And everyone accepted it. And then Hawke and Keating abolished that 30-20 rule. I think there is an argument, which we haven't had in this country, to say that super funds, in return for their tax benefits, that is to say they get taxed lower than companies, have to invest a certain amount into what the government needs, such as housing.
Yeah. So do people invest, in your experience, because you've had a lot to do with all sorts of investors, do they look for meaning in their investments or is 99% strictly financial?
Oh, well, look, human beings always want to do something meaningful. I think that's fair enough. But the thing is that when you're in the business of investing, it's competitive, right? I mean, the super fund directors sit around the table and the question is not what's the meaning of our investment is, but what's our returns? Because someone else is breathing down their neck, you know, and the same applies to, you know, managed funds and so on.
Well, they worry about their brand as well, I guess. They want to be seen as an attractive, good citizen brand to attract more investors, I guess. But yeah, no, I'll take your point.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm not saying that it's entirely about that. I mean, obviously, everybody's trying to ensure that they don't invest in things that are going to harm the environment, and that's fair enough.
I was going to ask you about, so I went to a briefing from state government about rezonings and about the patent book and all about planning. The whispers in the back of the room were all about no one's talking about cost. The elephant in the room is cost. They're all around the periphery. What, if anything, could be done, just putting aside, I guess, planning and those broader things, what can be done to drop the cost of production of housing, I guess?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, can the government subsidise it? Sure, but they haven't got much money. To the extent that it's the cost of cement and steel, well, what do they do about that? I don't know. It's difficult.
Yeah, but it's energy. And I guess that there's two main drivers, I guess, energy and labor. They're the things, materials in of themselves don't feel like they've gone up so much. Tiles are still, they've gone up marginally, but it's the labor and energy intense materials that are.
Look, governments have got out of the habit of intervening in markets and don't really like to do it. So I don't think they don't want to do it. It's too hard.
So it's got to be settings. It's got to be tax breaks, tax settings.
Yeah, that's right. You can do that, tax breaks. I mean, that's the way they have been getting investment in renewable energy going through tax breaks, and that works, that's for sure.
And I think, like, one thing that is counterintuitive to a lot of people, it's explained somewhat in your book. It's probably explained very well in your book, but it still feels counterintuitive. The fact that capital gains, tax breaks, and negative gearing is actually an impediment to supply, because it's peddled as something that helps supply, or referenced as something that helps supply. But if I'm not mistaken, in your book, you've outlined the fact that actually it is an impediment. It slows supply. It constrains supply.
I think I'm mainly on about the fact that it encourages investment demand. So it's been a, you know, it is and has been a force that's led to more demand from investment, as opposed to, so I think what's occurred as a result of negative gearing and the capital gains tax discount is that it's turned, helped to turn housing more into an investment asset as opposed to a place to live. And one of the problems we have is that we kind of all regard housing as the way to build wealth. And there's a lot of discussion about whether negative gearing and the capital gains tax discount contribute very much to the price of houses. And there's quite a few experts have done modeling on that and said that if you remove negative gearing and halve the capital gains tax discount, as the Labor Party proposed, that would make a very small difference, like 4% difference to house prices. And I think that, you know, sure, that maybe that's obviously true. But I think the problem is more fundamental than that, because those things tend to make people see housing as an investment asset rather than just a place to live. And I do think that it creates the wrong environment, the wrong thinking about housing. So I mean, I don't think those things actually restrict the supply, but they do sort of increase the demand.
So it just twists the market to, I guess, an imbalance where lots of, this is from your words, where 2/3 of the country are land owners and the other third is squeezed out, or I don't know if I got the proportions right. But
well, I sort of called it a cartel of the majority. I mean, most people own a house and they want the house prices to keep going up. And those who don't own a house think about it as the property ladder, and they have to get onto the property ladder, and how are we going to do that? And we need the bank of mum and dad to help us get onto the property ladder and all that stuff. I mean, I've been on about the fact that really what's needed is for house prices to not go up for a while, you know, like 10 or 20 years, for house prices not to change so that incomes can catch up. But when I say that to people, particularly my children who have just bought houses, they're horrified at the idea that house prices don't rise, because that's what they want. They need, everyone's kind of focused on the fact that house prices keep going up and it builds wealth. And that's true, but that's also the problem, that house prices keep going up and people are building wealth in housing. And we've got to the point now where housing has become unaffordable because of its increasing price.
And so what happens next?
Well, look, I think it's unlikely that we're going to get 20 years of house prices not going up. Maybe we'll get a situation where house prices will increase on average by the same as incomes, right? Incomes are going up at 3 or 4% a year, and I think probably that's what's going to happen. In which case, the 25-year period that we've been through of house prices outpacing incomes and increasing from 3 to 4 times incomes, the average income, to 9 times average income gets locked in. You know, that becomes a shift change in the price of housing versus everything else that has happened. And that's how it stays. So I think that's probably the most likely. You know, I think all of the actions that we've seen from governments are not going to produce the sort of oversupply of housing that would require prices would mean that prices don't rise for quite a long time.
Yeah. And so I guess in a nutshell, it's an imbalance, because, you know, one of the perspectives, I guess, from your kids or whoever is like, well, I don't need that much of an income if my house price accumulates because I'm building wealth, so I don't have to earn as much. I guess that's kind of the thinking, but it's the imbalance that causes that you argue.
No, you have to earn more to pay the mortgage. I mean, this is the problem we've got. And so if I'm right, and that's what happens, that basically the shift in the price of housing versus incomes gets locked in, then the structure of the economy and society will change. It has to change to accommodate that shift. And the shift, that change has only just begun. You know, like if you've got access to a bank of mum and dad to help you with your deposit, then you're fine. If you don't, you're not fine at all. You're probably renting. And the bank of mum and dad basically represents an early inheritance. You know, that like people, baby boomers passing on their inheritance to their children before they die. So that's a change that's taking place in the way society works. And that becomes permanent, right? Everyone's going to pay their inheritances early to help their kids get a house. But that only works if you've got some inheritance. That means that the baby boomers have to sell their house in order to free up the cash. So I think there's a lot of kind of things that have to and are changing in the way society operates to accommodate this shift, this change in the cost of housing.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to leave it. I really appreciate your time, Alan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay.
Thanks so much. I really, really appreciate you coming on. I've really enjoyed the chat. I felt a bit intimidated, but I'm very, very grateful that you've come on.
Okay, no worries.
Thanks, Alan.
You've been listening to Buildapedia. Please remember to like us and share our episode with your friends. We'd love your comments and suggestions. And we have a new website, buildapedia.au, where you can get in touch or leave a question and check out our blog.